صل على محمد وعلى محمد. Thank you very much. As always, I wanted to start the program today by showing you a video clip that I've been meaning to show you for the past three nights, but I always go over time. So I thought the best way is to show you before the program to force me to finish on time. It's a video clip that is a reciter by the name of Aghay Danishmand, who is reciting and giving a lecture in Iran. He's a popular speaker. You can find his CDs and DVDs in all over the places in Iran. And overall, he is a good speaker. But at times, his lectures deteriorate into a kind of this sectarian, you know, sectarian animosity. And I want to show you a clip that this is what we should not be doing. He's a good person, but these are areas that we should be very careful not to cultivate hate, especially in this globalized world. It's on YouTube everywhere. I got this from YouTube, and you see it. It's in Persian. So who knows Persian here? Okay, so we have at least one sister, and I think the brother there, I know, he knows Persian too. Anyways, what I'll do is I'll pause. I'll ask our youngsters to pause for me, and then I will translate for you periodically. But you can also try to see if you can figure out when he tries to say things about the caliphs.
اما یه جمله، حالا یکی میگه از آن بچه شما موز دنیا حروم زاده، حروم زاده با ولد و زنا دوتاست عزیز. ولد و زنا یعنی مادرش به خطا هست، اما حرام زاده یعنی این. من طبق فقه شیعه عرض میکنم، یکی از چیزایی که زن آدم به آدم حروم میشه اینه که آدم تو طواف نسایی که میره مکه دو رکعت نماز طواف نسا را نخونه، طبق حدیث پیغمبر امیرالمومنین. میتونم نشون بدم تو رسالات جناب عمر، تو باید میشه تو من نگاه کردی؟ لعنت الله رو یادون نره؟ خدا بیامرزه با من میگفت هر کی اسم اینا رو بشنره و لعن نفسه الهی نمی که
Okay, I think you're able to follow most of it, right? He says that there's a lady apparently, or I think a man had complained to him in his previous talk that how come you are so abusive vis-a-vis the caliphs, and he said, I'm replying to him. And he begins by saying there's a difference between haramzadeh and waladuz-zina. Both are illegitimate children, but there's a technical difference in fiqh between a child who is born out of wedlock and so on. Anyways, he wants to show the distinction, and he's now explaining how this difference comes about. Is anybody who does not do lan, you know, may God make his rizq haram.
این عمر حرام زاده، او دیگه هم حرام زاده بود، هم لعنت هم ولد و زنا بود. میدونید که
عمر was both haram, you know, ولد و زنا و حرام زاده، هر دو تا بود. میگه هم
دارم چون باباش خطاب اومد با یکی از کنیزا زنا کرد، بچه دار شد، دختر بزرگ شد با همون دختر خودش، اونم در حال هی زنا کرد، عمر بنو شد.
The father of Umar had married a person who was a slave girl, and while she was in the state of the monthly cycle, he had relationship and Umar was born. I can show you my sanad. I can show you my proofs. I have evidence.
تاق آقا دیروز نامه برای من نوشته از اول تا آخر فحش و توهین که چرا به سنی ها فحش میدی.
Yesterday a guy wrote to me a letter from top to bottom is nothing but insults against me, that why did you curse the caliphs.
جواب اون نامه اینه، برو یا به شیر مادرت نگاه کن یا به لقمه‌ای که بهت دادن.
The reply to that question is go and look for yourself. Either the milk of your mother, that means that maybe you are illegitimate yourself, or your father has some issues.
برو تحقیق بکن درباره خودت، ببین با چی درست شدی که این.
Go and research yourself as to how you came into being in this world.
جواب اون نامه اینه.
That's my reply to that letter.
حالا کارت به جای رسته که به آخوند شیعه فحش ناموس میدی به خاطر سنی.
He said, for the sake of Sunnis, you are giving insults to a Ruhani, to a Maulana, just because I cursed a Sunni. How is it possible you insult the prestige of a Maulana, a religious scholar?
به آخوند شیعه روزخون سید و شهدا توهین میکنی برای سنی.
You are insulting somebody who recites Roze Khun for Imam Hussein just because of the caliphs. Go and take a look at your mother and father and see what they have done.
Omar, la'natullah alayh. این ابو بکر لعنت الله علیه ناراحت گفت جناب ابو بکر چه مرگی تونه؟ شما را در مرض میبینم، چه مرضی تونه؟ گفت برم نقشه میکشم دشمن علی زیاد کنم، نمیدونم چه کنم.
ابو بکر says that I'm going to prepare a plan whereby I can increase the enemies against Imam Ali, to increase the hatred against Imam Ali. He's trying to devise a plan.
گفت حرامزاده، از من حرامزاده بپرس.
عمر says ask me, I'm حرامزاده like you, I'm also illegitimate like you, I can guide you.
گفت جناب حرامزاده چه کنی؟
He says جناب Mr. He's saying عمر ابو بکر said to him Mr. illegitimate child, how can I help you?
یادت یه روز رسول الله رو منبر فرمود علی جان تو میزان حلال زادگی و حرام زادگی هستی، هر کی تو رو دوست داشته باشه حلال زاده است، هر کی با تو بد باشه حرام زاده است. یادت
He says to Abu Bakr that you forgot when the prophet said from the minbar that Imam Ali is supposed to be the scale, the criterion. Those who love him will be from legitimate family and those who hate him will be from illegitimate families.
گفت اینجا داشته باش هر که حرومزاده شد با علی مشکل داره، درسته؟ گفتن که حالا ما چیکار کنیم حرومزاده زیاد میشن؟ گفت نمیدونم. گفت چقدر احمقی.
He says to him, how can we increase the number of people who will hate Imam Ali? And Omar says, you are so stupid, this is so easy.
عجب حرومزاده یه خری، مگه این نمیدونی فقه رسول الله هر کی میره مکه اگه طواف نسا رو انجام نداد و نمازشو نخوند زنش بهش حرام میشه؟ پیرمردا درست یا نه؟
Don't you know that we have this report from the prophet that whoever goes to Mecca and does not perform tawaf nisa, she is then prohibited to have any kind of intimacy with her husband.
بپرسید دیگه. گفت چیکار داره اینجا به علی؟ گفت باید نماز طواف نسا رو حرام کنیم که مرید ما نخونن تا زنا برشون حرام بشه، بچا بشن حرام زاده با علی بد بشه.
ابو بکر asked him, so what does this have to do with increasing the enemies of Ali? He says, well, we should devise a rule whereby the Sunnis will not perform tawaf on nisa, and as a result all their children will be out of wedlock and all of them will be illegitimate.
حالا میگی چه؟ حالا تو نامه می نویسی از یزد ما برو بیرون خائن اسرائیلی، مال اسرائیلی شدن. نوشته یه مش احمق نادون پا تو می شینن.
The guy who has written this letter to me says that around you are all donkeys and people of low intellect who surround you and listen to your garbage. In the letter he wrote. Go and look around the crowd. How many doctors do I have? How many professionals do I have in the audience right now?
خویی هیچی نیست جز حرومزادگی، هیچی نیست جز شیر ناپاک خوردن، هیچی نیست جز لقمه ناپاک خوردن.
It is so obvious that because you complain, you yourself are illegitimate and you have risk taken from haram sources. That's why you became like this, that you are insulting me.
Akhund,
yani Mawlana, be Mawlana, shoma mikhay tohin koni. How dare you insult the dignity of a Mawlana? He says, not only Abu Bakr and Umar, may the la'nat be upon all the Sunnis now.
امام اگه میگه وحدت 20 سال پیشو میگفتن یک، اولا امام نگفتن دو، یکی دیگه بود.
امام خمینی says 20 years ago he talked about unity, but he says Imam never said, he wasn't the one who began, it was Ayatollah Muntazari who began, but the Imam Ayatollah Khomeini endorsed it about the week of unity.
بنیان گذار وحدت شیعه و سنی امام نبودن. امام و لچه‌دارش نکنید خیر ببینید. امام نگفتن، رهبر انقلاب هم نگفت. یکی دیگه بود که الحمدلله سیلی فاطمه زهرا هم خورد و رفت.
The one who said about this unity with the Sunni was not Ayatollah Khomeini, but it was somebody else, and thank God that he has been discarded and thrown away like garbage. He means آقای منتظری. Who passed away actually today.
سانیان وحدت بین شیعه و سنی یعنی خفقون گرفتن شیعه، یعنی حرف نزدن، یعنی حقایق شیعه رو برای شیعه نگفتن، که چهار تا معلم برن سر کلاسه به بچه‌ها و جوانای ما بگن عمر خادم بوده.
Does it mean that when we talk about unity that we should not speak the truth, we should not speak about the doctrines of the Shia? Does it mean that we should go and teach our students in classes that Umar was a good helper of the Prophet, a good supporter of the Prophet? Umar was the one who made Iranians Muslims. Till I am alive and I have breath, I will continue to curse Umar and Abu Bakr. Rather, I will say every Sunni is illegitimate child. Because they don't recite Tawaf al-Nisa.
حرومه بشون طبق فقه شیعه، فقه اسلام، فقه نبوی.
The فقه شیعه is فقه اسلام and also فقه of the Prophet.
تو خیلی ناراحتی برای سنی ها، تو چه غلطی کردی چند تا سنی تو نفس شیعه کنی؟
Now that you are so upset that I curse the Sunnis, the one who wrote the letter, how many people have you converted from Sunni to Shia? With this tongue of mine which is so harsh, I have converted 13 Sunnis from Shia, although my tongue is so sharp like a blade. And there is one more that I am working on, inshallah wa ta'ala, they will become 14 for 14 ma'asumin. Wa sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Okay, let me get some of your feedback. I've done a pretty good translation, I think. If anything, I've been nice to him. Because in Persian, he says things that are quite insulting. I mean, these are profanities and vulgar profanities that normally one would not even say from a mimbar. I mean, but because he has such dislike for the caliphs, and somebody apparently made him very angry. Because when he gave a talk the night before, somebody criticized him and wrote a long letter. And apparently in the letter, he insulted this Aghai Danishman. And he says, this is my response. Nobody from the audience, it's a huge audience, by the way. The TV doesn't take you, but when it takes you, it's a huge audience. You know, nobody gets up in the audience. There must be, I would say, at least 800 to 1,000. He's a very popular speaker, you know. I'm sure they get good money. I mean, someone like me, we are very humdrum, you know. Nobody pays us, you know, big bucks. Because we don't create this kind of, you know, culture, you know. Any comments, brothers or sisters? Yes. آقای دانشمند.
Sorry, can I request you to use the mic, please?
Oh,
so
yeah,
that,
let's use
so we can
mic.
Hear you. Thank you.
I'm afraid that when you repeat this in society, our people mostly, I believe, not in here probably, but mostly people are quite, they have this prejudice about that I am Shia, I am better than Sunnis. And so they are kind of quite good recipients for this sort of speech. When you repeat that, you kind of make it stronger, this feeling, make the feeling more stronger.
Yeah, for us, you see, for us it is supposed to be kind of a forum to educate ourselves, you see. The people here do not subscribe to this kind of... nobody would, I think. I mean, if you are sane, and if you have an element of morality and ethics, the kind of vulgarities, we don't even say from member these kinds of words. In any event, for us, it's not a propagation for him. I don't want you to go and look at him. I hope nobody will. I mean, it's supposed to be a tool for us to see that the silence of the majority, silence of the audience, generates an open license to do whatever we like. If you don't challenge us, if you don't interrogate us, and don't take us to task for what we are saying, and let us have a blank check, we can do what he has done. And nobody gets up. I think for me it's such a big surprise. You know, this guy had the audacity, but he wrote, he didn't speak up. I think he thought they'll beat him up. But he wrote a letter to him. You know. So no, the idea is to educate ourselves what not to do. Brothers, any comments? Yes. Can somebody give you? Yeah.
I was just going to say, I think that, I've seen it from a few actually secular Iranians who show him. I think he's the kind of guy who a lot of the people who would go and listen to him, they listen to him because he's. In a twisted way, funny, because he just has such warped views of the world. So I think I don't think anyone takes him as seriously. And the people who you said were watching, maybe 800 or 1,000, either they're like-minded or they're watching him because it's funny. He's funny, but within the whole population, it's insignificant. So. I would be surprised if some very famous scholar or something would speak in the same... maybe they would have the same intentions, but they would speak more diplomatically.
Well, you're a good defender. Maybe you should be his attorney. You know, if you go to court for slandering and maligning and defaming a human being is a crime. I mean, in the West, you can sue people. If somebody maligns your character... and the character is an important element for you to earn a livelihood, you can sue him. So, you are being very positive. You know, my experience, I've traveled within Iran in Muharram all the way from Qom to Tabriz. I've been to various places, Shiraz and Isfahan, because I love Muharram, by the way. I really enjoy Muharram commemoration ceremonies in Iran. It's really remarkable. You know, and I'm not as optimistic as you are, you know. But what I would be hoping is this, that a person who recites this kind of, you know, hate talk should be advised. And his videos must be taken out from, you can find him everywhere. He's a popular speaker. It's not just there were 1,000 people in the audience. There are many thousands who listened to him. You know, we should not allow, I think, you know, and he is not a funny guy. He's not funny at all. He's a very serious guy. He fires at people all the time, you know. He's very abusive, you know. So anyways, that's but I like your defense. But not very convincing for me. Anyways.
I just want to ask how prevalent is talks like this is in your travels that you've gone through in Iran?
I wouldn't say that it is prevalent in the sense that you can go to every mosque or every, you know, Husseiniya, and this is the kind of discourse. The discourse is there of Sunni Shi'i sectarianism, but I think, like the brother said, it is done much more with a protocol, with some kind of diplomatic skills and etiquette. But the discourse remains, you know. But it's not the dominant discourse, especially in the years when Ayatollah Khomeini was around. You know, he had made a point that we are not supposed to expand and aggravate the differences, because this is the recipe for our own downfall. Even from the perspective of just strategic planning, let us say you believe that, okay, they deserve to be cursed, which I think is completely wrong. But even if you believe in this, you got to think as a big picture. And strategically, it is suicide to do this kind of a thing, because Sunnis are 80%, we are 20%. You do this, there's going to be a rebuttal. And it's going to be back and forth, ping pong. And that we see all this phenomena of now anti-Shi'ism. So it's not dominant. I would not say it's a dominant discourse within Iran. But certainly you can find pockets of such people. And I think now probably it's increasing, I feel. It has increased tremendously, I believe, in the past few years. The discourse of demagoguery, the discourse of demonization apparently has increased quite rapidly in the past, I would say, 8 to 10 years, unfortunately. It has increased substantially. Not just vis-a-vis Sunni and Shia, but even vis-a-vis within Shia. That if you don't agree with my particular vision and worldview, then that's it. You're open game. This is a very scary part, you see, because if you demonize the Sunnis today, you demonize first the mushrik. Then you demonize, after that, the unbelievers, the kafirs. Then you begin to demonize the Sunnis. Then you will demonize the Shia between you. You know, demonization itself is wrong. The moment you start doing something immoral, you teach your child, okay, stealing is good, but only from a mushrik. Stealing is bad, but only you can steal from a kafir. Stealing is very bad, haram, 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 it's gunai kabira, but you can steal from a Sunni. Stealing is abhorrent, but you can steal from those who don't agree with you, with your vision of what Shi'ism means. Once you cross that line, it's a slippery slope. You don't play with universal ethics. The moment you play with universal morals and relativize them, make them relative to your perspective, it's a big disaster. And this is the slippery slope that I see in Iran in the past 8 years. The discourse is becoming more and more exclusivistic. It's very wrong, very wrong. And it can destroy us, you know. It's a self-destructive strategy, you know. So, although it may not be the dominant theme, the trajectory, because of our fiqh, you know, and that's the point I want to make, inshallah, in the next two lectures, is develop the theme that law, ethics, theology, and history and politics are interrelated. You can't talk about theology and neglect to mention the political context. You can't talk about ethics and ignore theology. It's not possible. You can't talk about Islamic law and ignore Islamic universal ethics. You know? Sure. But do you see the point? The regression is gradual. You see, you may not notice it before, just like, you know, after the departure of the Holy Prophet. In the beginning, it seemed like it's a small issue. Okay, we disagree with you. You want to have your own people by consensus. We believe that so-and-so was chosen by the Prophet. It didn't seem like a big bifurcation. With time progression, you know, it's the phenomena of time can bring about such a disparity. The gap keeps on increasing, increasing, and increasing. And then you add more and more masala, of course. As time progresses, you add more and more stuff, more and more spices. That's normal. Isn't it true? People have made up stuff about Imam Hussein that are so not believable even. And you ask them, why did you do this? You know, one person asked one of these scholars, then how come you made this up? Even scientifically, it's impossible. He said that Imam Hussein, when he died, he had 6,666 arrows and spears. He was like a porcupine. Well, somebody did a study of the mass, the body of the surface of the... And you can't have 6,666. So he said, okay, so what? I made this up because I want people to remember Imam Hussein and cry for him. So even if I made it up, my intentions are good. My intention is for people to become good human beings. They should love Imam Hussein and follow his example to sacrifice for Islam. So my intentions are good. And he said, why did you pick 6666? He said, because the number of Quranic verses is 6,666. Do you agree? That's not even true. The number of Quranic verses is 6,236, plus or minus 2 or 3, depending upon, you know, there are some differing opinions on whether or not these are the same or not. In any way, it's certainly not 6,666. Although it's a popular number, you've seen many, many books that we have. They would say 666, because it's somehow magical. You know, the number looks good, right? We like this kind of... We want to make everything mysterious, you know. Anyways, this is something to be very mindful about. And that's why, this is not my opinion. It's just one opinion amongst hundreds of opinions. So don't take this to be the norm, of course. I don't claim to be the norm. I claim to be one opinion amongst many, of course. But this is a slippery slope. For example, I'll come to you, sister. For example, when you say death, marg bar amrika, when you say death upon somebody, the coil can come against you as well. One day they can say death against you, death against me. Because I began this cycle of saying death. Why say death to anybody? Of course, you will say death does not mean literally death. Well, you know that, but I, as an American who's sitting here and listening to television, and you said to me, death to America, death to Russia, and so on and so, death to Israel, and death to those who disagree with Walayat al-Faqih. Marg bar zidde Walayat al-Faqih. Well, you know exactly what you mean, but when you say death, for me the meaning is, you want me to be destroyed, to perish. If I were to say, for example, death to so-and-so, I don't think you will have a nuanced meaning of doing interpretation. It's a slippery slope. The moment we start doing things that are immoral, even against our enemies, and try to find a justification that, listen, I don't mean death, I mean I'm criticizing the American foreign policy. Well, say so. Why say death? Say that I'm criticizing the American foreign policy. Isn't better? Then there's no confusion now. But if you say death, and there was actually an American who was there, an American Muslim who was wearing a jeans with an American flag on his jeans. A true story. Again, I have not seen this, but my chain of transmission is very sound. It is not a ra'if, it's a very mutawatir hadith, or, you know, strong hadith. And this poor was a convert. Okay? So for them, it's very common to have these kinds of things. And, you know, even Muslims, you know, many people have American flags, and it's not an issue for them. You see, their cap has an American flag. In any event, in the Jummah prayers, when he heard this, he asked somebody, what are they saying about America? Because he said, Amrika. He didn't understand what they said. He said, what are they saying about America? I heard something. He said, well, I don't know how to say this, but let me explain to you. And he gave him a nice commentary as to what it means. But you see, there was no need for that. From the beginning, say what you want to say, and say it the way it should be said. Don't say something else, and then say, okay, now you do tafsir and ta'wil. Okay, we're not roomies here. We're not writing poetry. You know, just say what you want to say, but don't say death. In my view, it comes against us. You see? Because if you see people, let's say, who disagree with the American foreign policy, and there are many people who disagree, by the way, with American foreign policy. It's amazing. If you take a global vote, Majority of the people disagree with the American foreign policy. Do you agree? So they are with us. But if they hear us saying death, you take away a crowd away from it, that these guys are devilish people. They said death to so-and-so. These are barbarians. These are savages. What do you mean death? These guys kill people by, you know, this, what do you call, they hang people up and then they show you on television with a crane. You think it's, this is, you know, it's really, really, in my view, un-Islamic, believe me. You know, we are living in a global society. This is not living in a small village. The ramifications of our actions are phenomenal. And the damage that we do and the price that we pay is long term. You think it benefits our interest to show these kinds of pictures and say, this is Islamic now. What is so Islamic about penal penalty? You think Islam means to cut somebody's hand? Islam means to stone the adulteress? Islam means to hang somebody from the crane? Islam means just punishments? That's it? That's all Islam is about? Al-Qisas? You are mistaken. Islam is not about penal provisions. Rather, Islam is all about, if you look at the Quran, the penal provision is no more than maybe 1/20th of the Quran. Or even law. If you say law in totality, meaning ibadat and mu'amalat, law in totality is no more than 1/10th of the Quran. No more than that. If you are generous, no more than 500 verses. The other 9/10th does not talk about qisas, does not talk about fiqh, does not talk about law. It talks about spirituality. It talks about ethics. It talks about morality. It talks about human-to-human interrelationships, how to be ethical. It's a human interaction that is of paramount importance, human to the nature. But we say an Islamic State means you must punish people. So Islamic State, how do you define Islamic State? Islamic State means you hang people. Islamic State means you cut. They have equated Islamic State to Islamic penalties. It is such a blunder. Such a phenomenal, colossal blunder. Because Islamic State does not mean this at all. At all. You think Saudi Arabia, because they do all this stuff, it becomes Islamic State? Whereas America can never be treated as a state that has Islamic principles. We're talking about principles here. We're not talking about name, you know, badge, Islamic. Well, anybody can say, tomorrow we can say Islamic State of UK. So what? If the name is important, we'll say Islamic State. Islamic Republic of Pakistan. And then you look at the actions. It betrays everything about Islam. So I think it's extremely, extremely critical that we should, when it comes to moral values, our moral sharpness should not be, there should be no element of vagueness, ambiguity. Morality cannot be ambiguous. The moment you open up the truth, this can of worms of ambiguity, that there are gray areas, you can slip around, that your rights are different as a Muslim than your rights as a kafir. Very dangerous phenomena. If human rights are not universal, human rights are now being particularized depending upon your identity, you have begun the slippery slope of demonizing human beings. The Quran does not speak like that. The Quran says, Karamna Bani Adam. It says, oh, children of Adam, we have given you nobility. Well, if God has given nobility to human beings, don't you think if you call them najis, if you call them impure, it is not undignified? We teach our children, what is najasat? You know, what is najasat? Do they teach you in the madrasa? Let's see if you are a good madrasa or a bad madrasa. This is the test. You know, if you don't pass the test, that means it is Mehfil Ali. But if you pass the test, well, it is not Mehfil, you know. But this is the attitude. Well, what would they say is najasat? They will say things like, you know, urine, feces, dog, pig, kafir. You think it jives? It is jarring. Mushrik. I mean, even forget about fiqh. If somebody just comes and tells you like this, it is going to be jarring for you. Because here you are combining things that are non-human entities, and then you want to group within these non-humans a human being. I mean, they're worthy of some. And God says, "Lakad karamna bani Adam." Where is the dignity? You know, I don't know if you heard the Sheikh, the Mufti, and I'm so sorry, but you know, this is something that is very dear to me. So, anyways, it is part of our talk. It's about ethics. Ethics. Innama bu'ithu liutammima maqarim al-akhlaq, said the Prophet. That the only reason why I was sent for the ministry of prophethood was to bring about perfection to human moral ethics. Not about prayers, not about najasat, not about khums. Makarimul akhlaq was my only, you know, in Arabic when you say innama means exclusive. The only reason, the sole reason why I was sent for the ministry was to perfect human moral conduct. Surprising. Not about cutting people's hands and putting them on the crane. There was one guy, a mufti from Azhar. He was in Australia. He lived there for a number of years. I don't know if you heard. No? Okay. Then it's good. You guys don't listen at all to the American news. I got the picture. You guys still believe that UK is as powerful as it was before. It's over now. You know, it still is. Oh yeah, no, Fox News is something else. I'm ashamed even that, you know, we have Fox News. And it's watched by majority of Americans. Majority of Americans watch Fox News, by the way. It's really sad. I remember when Mr. Bush was re-elected, one of the newspaper here said, how can, I don't know, the percentage, how can these people be so foolish or be so stupid? There was a big newspaper article here in one of these British. Anyways, we are not so politically nuanced and politically literate as you guys are. We are not even literature-wise literate. Like, for example, if you go on a tube, Britishers like to read. Is it true? I mean, no, you won't find us reading. You know, no, we stare at each other and we do many things. We listen to the iPod, you know, but we don't read. It's a very different culture, you know. I shouldn't say all, of course, not all North Americans, but this is unfortunately the issue. The Mufti, his name is now, I'm forgetting, but it's not so important. But he was a Mufti, it means he can give fatwa. Anyways, I'm getting old. It's not important, is it? But it's going to bother me till the end of the majlis now, you see. In any event, what had happened was some of the Arabs were convicted of raping some of the Australians. I don't know that how many women. Anyways, when it came to the court, apparently the court gave a very stiff sentence that was disproportionate in comparison to the crime that was committed by others in the same kind of a situation. So the Mufti, they belonged to his crowd, I think. The Mufti was very angry that you are discriminating against us because we are Arabs and it's post September 11th. So in the Jummah khutbah, he lost his temper like this guy. They don't know that these things travel nowadays. And in the khutbah, he said, one, he condemned the judge and the legal system, the judicial system. Secondly, he said, you know, if these women had stayed in their own private quarters, this thing would never have happened in the first place. You know, imagine, he says, let me give you an example. If you put out meat on your backyard and then you see a cat or an animal that comes and attacks the meat, whose fault is it? The meat or the animal? You see, comparing a human being to meat. He doesn't even regard the non-Muslim women as even worthy of being compared to human beings. He compares him to animals, non-human species. You see the danger? When you say kafir are so-and-so, kafir are, you can take the organs from a kafir, even if he doesn't agree with you, you can just rob him if you need, if you're Muslim. But you should never give your organ. No. Muslim? No. Haram. Mutlaqan haram. Because you are so sacred, you are so precious. Because you are Muslim. Why you are Muslim? Because you said the kalama. That's how you become Muslim. Because you said kalama, yath shahadatain, now you have some kind of enormous amount of dignity and self-respect and all this. But you, kafir, no matter how good he is or she good, she always remains undignified. I think it's something wrong in ethics. You know, you relativize ethics, big, big hazard, big danger that can lead to disaster. And we are seeing disasters, like I'm saying. If you create a culture of hate, the hate will come against you one day. And it is. It is coming right against us, that we as Shias cannot live with each other. And it's happening. It's happening. Look at the situation unfolding in Iraq. Situation unfolding in Pakistan. You start the process, you can't put a stop to it. What is happening in Iran? You think America is involved? You think UK is involved? Absolutely no, in my opinion. Absolutely no. You think all these guys who disagree now have somehow been purchased by the United States? USA is that powerful, you think? No, it's not true. We should be very honest. Otherwise, we can't rectify the problems. If we continuously find outside enemies, the reason why Muslim world is so backward, why the Muslim world lost its zenith of civilization is because of the others, because of colonialism. Yes, yeah, they played a big role in devastating our confidence, you know. And that's why the narrative, you know, our narrative, when we talk about how the Muslim world came to a decline, it should not begin with September 11th, like, you know, Friedman has done in New York Times. He talks about the narrative, that how come Muslims are so bitter. And he begins the narrative from September 11th and moves on. That's not the right point to start. The right point to start is the beginning of Muslim colonization. Colonization of Muslim mind and the Muslim lands. From that narrative, then you see why Muslims are so angry. But if you begin from September 11th and say, okay, how come Muslims are so angry? It doesn't make sense. But if you begin from the period of colonization and what they have done, then you say, oh no, Muslims should be upset what has happened to them. But yes, okay, what do you expect from others? Of course they will try to destabilize us. This is in their interest. What is in our interest? We should be smarter. What is our strategic plan? What is our strategy? What is our vision to be able to move in such a way? And we are not few in numbers. We are 1.4 billion. So it's no joke to say, you know what, I mean, we don't have resources, we are few in number. I don't know what to do, we don't have many countries, we don't have resources. How many countries are Muslims? It's no excuse to continuously find faults in others. Relieves you of our own accountability. Bashing Sunnis relieves us of our own responsibility, as Shiis. If I bash the West, it protects me, myself. Isn't it? If I can find an outside devil, it gives me safety net. It's always good to have enemies. The United States has found a good enemy, terrorism. The moment you say the word safety and security, we need to fight terrorism, the Americans become numb. You can take away rights now. This is their particular strategy. Our strategy may be never to blame ourselves. We are just so perfect. We are so perfect. Our ulama are so perfect. Our maraji are so infallible. You can't even say one word to begin to even start an intellectual dialogue with them. And not just an ordinary, those who are educated in the field, we can't even speak. Can you imagine? Paralysis, intellectual paralysis. I'm not saying I'm highly educated, but I have done some research to be worthy of saying something, but no, you can't. You as a profession in your field, cardiology and medicine and dentistry and pharmacy, you are equally highly educated to be able to engage in the Muslim discourse. This is exactly how it was when we were in our zenith. We had philosophers, we had scientists, we had astronomers, we had biologists, we had people in the industry of optometry. Our scholars were multidimensional. They were not just faqis. Faqih meaning just law. They were experts in logic, experts in mathematics, experts in physics, experts in many fields. Look at many of our scholars. you will see that it was not one field of law. And it's a pity. Today, Islamic law has become so dominant that the Quran is even now secondary. If you want to become a jurist, you don't need to understand the whole Quran. You don't need to understand the Quran in totality. You need to understand only those Quranic verses that pertain to law, that is 500 verses. Why do you not understand the entire Quran? Quran is our pillar. Law has taken that kind of dominant role that you can't even begin to touch it. You know? And many of us, you see, you must remember, many of us who serve the community, we are paid by the community. And therefore we are at the behest of your grace. And that compromises what we can say. Perhaps maybe I could not say this if I was under the treasurership of an Islamic center. Because if we say things and tomorrow you don't like us, right? You can fire us. You can say, no, he said things that our marjas... gone. But don't you have a brain to think a little bit more than that? A little bit more, you know? Just you get a signal and it's over for any kind of scholarship. I mean, it's a joint responsibility. If you say, for example, how come you as those who are progressive scholars, you guys don't come out on the cutting edge and talk about real issues and show us, well, it's a joint responsibility. What backing do I have if I go on, you know, if I talk the way you want me to speak? What backing do I have? Yes, you might cry for me, you might pray for me. I'm pretty sure your heart will bleed for me, but that's it. Otherwise, I'm in history. I'm gone. Right? So it's a joint responsibility, brothers and sisters, you know. It is not a one-way street. And because we have regarded this as a one-way avenue, that somehow all the answers come from here, you know. And because we have this one-way monologue, it develops a kind of... our brain circuit is like this, you know. It is now really... We are brained this way, you know. And the moment the circuit says something else, psh, the fuse goes out. Well, we need to reconfigure the wires, you know. And I really say this honestly, there are many, many, many scholars, believe me, that I know of, who share the similar kind of worldview that you share, the similar kind of vision that you share, but they are restrained. They are restrained, you know. And I don't blame them at all. I don't blame them at all, not even one bit. Until and unless scholars become independent financially, they become autonomous, they can't speak their mind. It's impossible, really. When you are under the thumb of somebody else, you know, this is why we have tenureship in university, is that once you are tenured, the whole rationale of tenureship is, once you are tenured, you can speak your mind and write whatever you like, and nobody can ever fire you. But before tenureship, of course, be on guard, right? You can't say mean things about your dean or university and so on. In any event, this is just something I wanted to share with you, part of ethics. Ethics are universal. We need to be very mindful that we don't compromise the universality. And that's why I think it's very critical. Islamic law and faith and ethics are organically intertwined. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Sister, sorry.
No, I don't know if I understood you correctly, but when you were saying about... I was wondering where the defamation of the Khalifs came, how did it come around? So maybe is it... Because if we take something like Ziyarat-e-Ashura,
right,
or we take the khutbah of Bibi Fatma, and I feel as when one reads, at least when I read it, when the khutbah of Bibi Fatma, I felt she couldn't have said that.
Right.
But I feel when one reads this and one takes it as a truth, then it becomes like a moral obligation to be a follower of Fatma, of Hazrat Fatma, to criticize the first Khalif. But it still jars with me when I read that khutbah.
Right. Well, inshallah, let me try and cover this issue that, you know, when did this process of what you call sab, the institution of defamation, began? I mean, we all know that Imam Ali lived with the caliphs, isn't it true? Do we have any evidence that he went to any of these caliphs and said, you know what, I curse you? No, we have no evidence. As a matter of fact, he would give them advice whenever he felt he was not a politician, that let them fall and I'll laugh at them. You know, it requires a very different kind of approach, you know. And even for those who believe that this defamation and slander and la'an is part and parcel of being a Shia, do you think that we follow everything that our imams have told us? That this becomes so important that if you don't do this, we have lost Shiism? Is this like 99% of Shiism? We don't follow many other things that are far more important, don't you think? That for this issue, for us becomes, you know, life and death. Even if you believe, let's say you believe that this is something that the Imams did this, that something that Fatima al-Zahra did this, and you have concrete evidence. Even then, well, that's what I said yesterday as well. We have to ask the Maraja. We have to ask the scholars what is their opinion. But defamation, you know, is not the dominant theme in our Imams' talks. For example, did you know some of our Imams used to name their children Aisha? They have named their children Abu Bakr. They have named their children Umar. They have named their kids Uthman. Can any Shia today do that, you think?
And it's also written, I think, in Damascus, where they've kept the heads of the Shahada'i Karbala. There are many names of, like you're saying.
Yeah. But imagine, I mean, you know, today somebody would say, I'm going to name my daughter Aisha. The Imams did so. You know, it's something, you know, the Imams are quite different, I believe. Their paradigm, their particular nobility, they were of very high standing, very high standard, you know, to be able to draw them down in this kind of dirty, you know, politics. They were far more grander, I think. You bring them down and make them so cheap. As if this is Shiism. Shiism means do la'an. Even if it is proven, this is not 90% of Shiism, so it can, you know, we have a concept of maslaha. For example, how come Ayatollah Khamenei, he said, no more sinezani, kamezadan, but zanjir, by blood. They said, wait, everybody does so, and we always did this, and he said, no, it is against public welfare, public interest, don't do it anymore. So, well, even if this cursing, let's say, is proven, it is against public interest right now, don't you think? It's against public welfare. The harm is more than the benefit. So even by recourse, invoking maslaha principle, okay, still you can ignore it for now. That perhaps maybe is a very diplomatic answer and a diplomatic way of progressing. It is in our best interest to ignore this kind of malicious things that can do us a lot of harm and is doing a lot of harm. Sallallahu alaihi Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Now, of course, none of these minutes count because this is not part of my talk, although it is part of my talk. Anyways, I think I've almost finished my time, right? So, anyways, let me tell you what I was going to say, and I'll say it tomorrow. I was going to talk about the multi-dimensions of any religion to become a cohesive entity, for any religion to be a holistic entity and not become exaggerated or extremist. All these dimensions must be within a religion and they must be in due proportion. The moment you make a religion primarily a particular dimension, you are preoccupied with that dimension at the cost of other dimensions. This is the beginning of what we call the phenomena of extremism or the phenomena of exaggeration. The phenomena of fanaticism comes about when you have narrowed your vision and have ignored other aspects of religion that are equally integral part of developing our worldview and our vision. What are those dimensions? And I'll elaborate further. One of the dimensions of religion is what we call the ritual aspect of religion, the practical component of religion. For example, liturgy, prayers, fasting. The rituals are equally important in any kind of a faith tradition because it gives a sense of cohesiveness, a sense of normalcy, a sense of repetitiveness. It's very, very important for people to believe that they have certain rituals that unite all of them and they can have this sense of continuity and repetitiveness. Very good. We also need what we call a component of experiential or an emotional component. Imam Hussein is fundamental. There has to be a component that is emotive, that can power you up, just like it powered me today through emotions, doesn't mean that you become irrational. Emotions are also a gift of God. Emotions also help us in becoming spiritual. For example, we have in ethics the faculty of anger, the faculty of emotion. It's absolutely good. As long as you don't become excessive or you fall short. If you are within the balancing parameters, it's absolutely good. Emotion is something good. So religion also needs that element of vibrancy, the element of dynamism, the element that can motivate people and bring about results. Islamic revolution of Iran, in my opinion, would never have materialized without Imam Hussein ibn Ali. Impossible, in my view. Many of you will agree, those who know the dynamics of this revolution of 1979, it was Imam Hussein who was really leading them in terms of that emotive power. How come this kind of revolution doesn't happen in Egypt, in the Sunni world? But in the Shia world, there's this concept of we don't accept oppression. We stand up for justice. There's an element of self-preservation of one's dignity. You know? And this is the current crisis within Iran, is there is a sense of a group of people who feel that their dignity is not respected. It's very dangerous. When Shias feel that you are being humiliated, they will not take it. When Shias believe that you are unjust to them, they will not take it. It's very dangerous. So we need this emotive phenomena, and it's very helpful. So we should not say all the time, oh, you know what, I'm so rational, and any kind of, I don't cry. I don't do matam. This is childish, you know. I'm very intellectual. It's a mistake. It's a big mistake. The Prophet used to cry. We have evidence the Prophet wept in certain cases. We have evidence Imam Hussein wept. When he was given the report that his emissary, Qais bin Mushir, had been massacred from the top of the palace, when he was asked to curse, and instead he began to praise Imam Hussein, and his body was mutilated, and somebody reported to him when Imam came to Batn al-Aqiq, or I think Zubala, the Imam wept. All the reports that we have, Sunni and Shia, Tariq al-Tabari, and our own sources as well, in Shia sources, they say the Imam could not control his tears and he cried. I said, the Imam is, you know, he should be strong and he is masoom and he is so and so and he is so intellectual. Huh? He should not cry. The Imam wept publicly. And he said, I can't control my tears here. And he read a very nice Quranic verse, which tells us that the Imam is almost predicting his end. And I'm sure all of you know the Quranic verse, which says, from the Quran, he says, "من المؤمنين رجال صدقوا ما عهد الله عليه. فمنهم من قضى نحبه ومنهم من ينتظر وما بدلوا تبديلا." There are people, there are believers amongst humanity who have been true to their contract, to their covenant with God, their agreement with God. And there are those who are going to fulfill their agreement. That is, the end is coming. But they never change the contractual agreement. They never break their contract with God. فَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ يَنْتَظِرْ وَمَا بَدَّلُوا تَبْدِرْ. They never change their course. Now he wept. So is it a problem? He's emotional, he's not intellectual. No, it's a big mistake. The other element is to have what we call a narrative. Every religion needs a sacred narrative or narratives. We need different. For example, we have a Karbala narrative. We have the Prophet's life narrative. These are very important in developing a religious worldview, a religious mindset. We have what we call an element of, here is the intellectual underpinning. We need to have doctrinal and philosophical foundational components for religion. This is now where the brain comes in. Theology comes in. Philosophy comes in. The science of logic comes in. All these are important now to understand the phenomena of religion. It is one among seven. If you skew one way, it is extremism. If you skew the other way towards ritual, another extremism. Looking for the balance, al-wasat. وَكَذَلِكَ جَعَلْنَاكُمْ أُمَّةً وَسَطًا. We are the balanced community. Anyways, we'll talk about this. The fifth component is, there has to be an element of ethics. An element of law, and what I say is that law and ethics. You can separate them if you like. My belief is, my opinion is, they are inseparable. You separate them, you create possible contradictions and possible schizophrenic mentality. They go hand in hand. Because my belief is, God has not asked us to do anything that is immoral. The Prophet would never have asked us to do a thing that is unethical. It is beyond God's wisdom and beyond God's dignity and grandeur to ask us to do anything that is unethical. Impossible. Our God is a just God. Our God is a loving God. Our God is a God who has wisdom. Another attribute of a religion is we need to have what we call social components or institutional components. We need institutions, mosques and so, religious scholars and whatever. We also need, this last element is material component. Religion exhibits itself in different forms. For example, your architecture. You have poetry. Poetry is very powerful. If you are Iranian and somebody brings about the poetry of Saadi or Rumi, it will change your relation. When I was in the Auckland Center, the strategy of getting back the young Iranians was not by telling them, come and listen, otherwise God will send you to hell. They just won't listen to you. But if you talk, let's get together in a poetry session of Rumi, they will come. And Rumi talks about universal values. The way to attract Iranians, and even till today I believe, the way to attract Iranians is not by sermonizing. Because Iranians have a very different perspective on religion, because they have gone through a different series of events. They are not Khojas. They are not, you know, they are not Arabs. They have gone through different... The only way that you can pull them... Mehfil-e Ali's tradition, which has to be different. I'm not saying that you have poetry sessions, by the way. I'm saying based upon the Iranian psyche that I knew, the strategy of getting more people was by poetry. You could pull them in and then talk about universal values. I'm sure Mayfield will have his own strategy, but certainly you want to increase, you don't want to decrease, you want to increase our numbers, because I think you have something that is very foundationally good. Why not spread the message? Why should we remain a small club? I think we need to expand. Why not expand? But we need to, of course, strategize. We need to have a strong strategy of growth and movement. Anyways, these are some of the elements that we'll talk about tomorrow. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Salawat. I will not speak about her. The sister did a very good job, you know, Sister Kulthum. So thank you for making my job easier and making your task even easier. Otherwise, I would take another 10 minutes away from you. But, you know, she did a wonderful job as always. And now you guys do such a wonderful job that I don't feel so surprised anymore. It's over now. Because every day it's good. So what do I do now? Okay, the first 2-3 days were exciting for me. But anyways, thank you very much. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.